Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. Our podcast today is on the circular economy and all of the fun ways to make resources go further that fall under that. We have a really good discussion panel here today. We have former European Commissioner Yanis Potocnik, who is now with the International Resource Panel, and joining him is Bruegel's Heather Graby and Luca Moffat, who have written a paper that was out in September on the circular economy. You can find all of these papers on our website, bruegel.org, and today you'll get to hear us talk about how this is going and what it all means. Heather, can you give us an overview of what is the circular economy? It's not just a recycling chain, right? It's about how you use stuff from the beginning and around and around before the end?
Absolutely. It's about cradle to cradle. So if you think about nature, nature never wastes anything. Everything is reused right down to when it sinks back into the earth and becomes soil once again. And in fact, we humans could have systems that are like that. At the moment, we have a little bit of recycling where we try and make stuff out of other stuff. But actually, if you just take the stuff in itself, you can do a huge amount to make it much more resource efficient using as little extracted from nature as possible from the beginning. In fact, there are studies that we cite in the paper that show that about 80% of the greenhouse gas emissions and other environmental impact of products in key sectors that are really polluting, these impacts could be eliminated at the design stage. So eco-design is really fundamental right at the beginning of the life of a product. And then you basically work your way through, try and reduce the number of resources consumed in making the product and then in using the product, and then make it reused as many times as possible until finally you get to recycling.
This is so vindicating for those of us who take our plastic bags and hoard them until they've got holes in them and can't be used anymore.
But you could do this also with buildings. It's not just, you know, that we think of these things as individual goods, but you could do this refrigerators, buildings, whole systems in the economy.
Amazing. And Yanis, your group has been putting together data on just what the state of play is and presumably allowing policymakers to use that to figure out how to make it better. Can you tell us about what you're doing and how it fits into this research?
Yeah, thanks. The first thing which I would like to add to what Heather was saying is that when we are talking about in scientific panel, when we are talking about how to reorganize life, our main conclusion is that we would need to decouple the well-being growth from economic growth, both from resource use and altogether from environmental impacts, which is, at the end of the day, the core thing. So we call that decoupling. And when you talk about circular economy is actually an instrument in delivering decoupling. One is, I would say, theoretical concept, and the other, it's more pragmatic, practical concept in real life. Our figures are showing that unsustainable resource use is basically driving the triple planetary crisis. We can explain approximately 60% of climate change via the resource extraction and use, 40% of impacts on the health and pollution, and more than 90% of impacts on land-related biodiversity use and also water stress. So basically, many times, various panels are talking about consequences. We are talking about core drivers leading to those consequences and trying to depeg behind what is actually the thing which is impacting all of environmental impacts. So going back to the drivers and pressures, to the logic why these things are happening, and then trying to connect that with all economic reasons which would need to be seriously dealt with, which leads us then to the solutions.
Luca, what are ways to look at resource use numbers and change something as opposed to just going, huh, I guess that's what's going on?
Well, there are many ways that we can implement the principles of circular economy that we're talking about. So you can do this across sectors, in different industries, from agriculture to steel to iron. So one study, for example, showed that emissions could be reduced by 34% by 2050 relative to 2018 if you were to implement circular principles across seven major sectors in the economy, such as steel, such as iron, such as the mobility sector. Also, you can reduce emissions in agriculture by using regenerative agricultural techniques, or by or you can change the way that forestry is done using forestry techniques, which are not done at wide scale at the moment. And the reason that these things are not done at a large scale is because the incentive structure is not there. We live in a society where resource use is not something which has been focused on, in stark contrast to energy efficiency. So many of the incentive structures that are there do not make firms want to make resource efficient decisions.
Can I just add?
Please.
Yeah. Can I just add one thing to that? Because actually, in the last report, Global Resource Outlook 24, in IRP, we go a bit further than Luca explained. We are claiming that economic system designed by industrial nations is wasteful and unjust, and that we need to set the order right. Economy is there to serve humans, and not the opposite, which means that we have to ask the question how to meet the human needs. We call them provisioning systems in the most resource and energy efficient way, which is actually not talking about sectors. It's not talking about various kind of things. So we don't talk about how to optimize the car. We talk about and car industry, but we talk about how to optimize mobility, which is what actually people need, because at the end of the day, we do not need car. And I think this is a really important shift in the logic, because it's basically leading you more to the well-being understanding, and it's departing from the classical GDP understanding-driven economies. And I think it's really important that a scientific body, which is basically on the UN level, has pushed this logical transformation and approach to a different next level.
You were at the highest levels of Brussels decision making. This seems like a big shift from traditional ways of thinking about government and economic stimulus and economic growth. How do you see the contrast, and how do you imagine making the cultural change necessary to have this decoupling that you were speaking about?
It's not easy, because the traditional way, it's pretty much locked in our behavior and understanding. For example, it's very difficult to depart from the GDP growth, because the model which we have developed is that we have practically very much indebted nations, indebted also individuals. And through that, if we do not have economic growth in the future, somehow the economic system will collapse. So we have, in a way, locked ourselves into the model, which is unfortunately not sustainable. So it will be very difficult to come out. But solutions do exist. And when I was mentioning before, I think what is essential is to understand that the utmost level of the circularity, it's basically how to reform economic systems. And when you reform economic systems, that doesn't mean that you, by definition, attract economic growth. No, you provide it in different way. You provide it, for example, through the services instead through the products. Heather was mentioning a very good element of eco-design, but also Luca was mentioning a good element of economic signals. You know, if economic signals to producers and consumers would be right, you don't need eco-design, because economic signals would basically drive the producers to design the products in a way that they would last, in a way that they would meet our needs quicker.
In the next section of our podcast, we're going to talk more about strategic autonomy and the way that intersects with the need to protect the planet.
Heather, can you walk us through sort of the outline of that debate? On the one hand, we have folks like Mario Draghi in his competitiveness report saying the EU needs to make sure it has secure lines of raw resources to make the things we need. On the second hand, the EU has very ambitious climate goals that will require a change in how we use resources. And in the third hand, there is this cultural shift that we've been discussing already. How do we think through that?
Well, Draghi focuses on critical raw materials for the green transition and the fact that in Europe we're rather resource poor as well as being energy poor as a continent. And he makes the case for a circular single market very much around this issue of the critical raw materials. But it's actually a much broader issue, as Janos was saying, of how we use all resources and how inefficient our current system is. Because, and as Draghi says, Draghi kind of points to the fundamental market failure, the fundamental failure really of a lacuna, a gap in economics about the fact that we don't price environmental externalities. So Draghi says deep in part B of his 400-page report, he actually says the economics would change if negative environmental externalities associated with resource-intensive production would be internalized. So that's economic speak. For saying that if we actually put a price on environmental damage like greenhouse gas emissions, like destruction of biodiversity, like pollution of water, and so on, then secondary materials, i.e. the things that we can take back from what's already in circulation in the economy, those secondary materials would be much cheaper than the virgin materials because the extraction of the virgin materials would be much more expensive because you'd have to pay for the environmental costs of extracting them. But at the moment, they just don't appear. They are not there in GDP measures. They're not there in accounting systems. It's as if they don't exist, but actually they do exist. And that's why the circular economy is not there yet. And the reason why Draghi mentions this is he's concerned that as Europeans, we have this model of what he calls the commodity import model, where we have to import nearly all of our raw materials, a very large proportion of them, particularly for clean tech, because we don't produce those things on our continent. And so by importing less of them, we're less dependent on countries that could become hostile towards us, or supply chains that could be broken, or commodities that could become much more expensive, where there's a lot of price volatility. And those are the three elements also mentioned by Enrico Letta in his report. So they're pointing to a circular single market providing more strategic autonomy, more economic security for Europe. But it's a much more fundamental issue, which is that our economic system has massive hidden inefficiencies in it. So it would actually boost European competitiveness if European firms moved to resource-efficient production.
Look, when I was reading your paper, I was struck that it's more the interlocking rings economy than the circular economy because of the way you emphasize reusing materials at every stage. Can you help us, people who don't have that model already in their head, can you help explain that to them in terms of it's not just one cradle to cradle, it's keeping these loops at every stage so that there's less waste in the economy?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And in fact, we have several examples of how that can really happen at scale. One example is right here in the EU in Denmark. It's called Kalundborg Industrial Park. And there you have Novo Nordisk, which I'm sure many of the listeners will know. It's the EU's highest valued firm, a pharmaceutical company. And you also have several other companies, which are all located in close proximity. And over the course of about 50 years, these companies have managed to identify where different outputs or waste can actually be an input into another company's production. One example is the generation of steam from a power plant, which has been diverted to several other companies who need steam as an input. Another example is pharmaceutical waste sludge, which comes from Novo Nordisk, which has been found to be used as an input into another company, which is located in proximity. So this is just one example. Another example happened in the UK, where firms came together through an independent body who brought them together. It was sponsored by the government, and it brought companies together who would normally not want to share information for fear of losing competitiveness or for their rivals finding out secrets about their internal production processes. And they found that by introducing a neutral actor who could bring all of these different firms around the table, they were able to identify areas of synergy which would prevent materials going to waste. So one example from someone that we've spoken to who was there at the time, there was a milk company who was storing milk in these huge steel vats, and they revealed that they were just throwing these things away. And on the other side of the room, you had a steel recycler looking incredulous at the whole thing, and they signed a deal on the spot right there. So those are just two examples of how, in maybe the kind of narrow example of industrial symbiosis, these you can have several loops and lose as little resource as possible.
That's really interesting. Yanis, how does that vision of cooperation fit with the competitiveness side of economic development that we hear so much about? Because being competitive often means trying to do something a little bit better than the other guy.
Yeah, maybe we should start talking from the point of view that the world in which we are living, it's very much different than it was a generation ago. We are basically the first generation which is living in the socio-ecological space of planetary scope, if I explain that. So even the Second World War or the First World War were not the world wars. They were basically local wars on many parts of the world. It became a kind of world threat when nuclear weapon was invented. And of course, we see the effects of climate change. We see the internet, artificial intelligence, trade. All those things are basically talking that we are much more interconnected and dependent, and that many of those problems could not be solved in different way than actually through the cooperation. Because simply, it's unsolvable on lower level, even on European level, which is a great model of cooperation. So this, how to basically agree about those things on a global level, I think it's central. One thing which I'm missing, since we are talking about circular economy in these debates, is that we would much better introduce material logic into all our talks, meaning that we would probably need to set some kind of material targets, because we need to understand that if we just clean the supply side, which currently is main part of the attention, we will not do the trick. It's a lot about the demand side. Who is actually overshooting the planetary boundaries? Who is overconsuming? And we should set the limits and the boundaries not only on CO2 emissions, but also on the second part, on how much of the materials, everything extracted from the earth, we are actually using. Which means that we need to couple decarbonization with dematerialization, and that we have to couple resource efficiency also with sufficiency logic. And that is the only way also to get the global south on board, because via that you basically talk about fairness, equity, and all those questions which are central in international relations.
That's really interesting. So we decouple resource use from economic growth, but then we recouple, as it were, some of these global alliances and global relationships. Heather, let's talk some more about the Global South. We see with, for example, the EU's carbon border adjustment mechanism, it is really going after the CO2 emissions, but there are some countries that are really dependent on resource extraction for their livelihoods and don't have an alternative to turn to if the EU becomes a more expensive place to sell. How do we grapple with that?
Well, this shows how much the transition to a sufficiency economy, as Yanis was saying, essentially a globally sustainable economy for the long term, depends on looking at the much bigger loops that really bind us all in this global economy. So you can't just change one supply chain or another. You really need to think across the economic system as a whole. So when it comes to resources, there's a justice issue and there's also a long-term sustainability issue. So the justice issue is about the fact that we here in Europe consume so much more than other continents per capita. So the average European in a year consumes three times more in terms of materials than the average African. The average American consumes even more than the average European. The Americans really top the charts in terms of consumption. And the European population is only 6% of the global population, but our consumption uses somewhere between 3/4 and 97% of the safe operating space across planetary boundaries. So our consumption, which is driving that extraction from nature in the global south, is an issue of justice. It's a measure of historical justice because this has been going on for a couple of centuries since we've been doing the Industrial Revolution. And we used to do this through colonialization. Now it's done through the global economy, but the net effects are the same. So obviously it would affect a lot the countries where the extraction is happening if they were no longer able to sell very environmentally damaging goods into the EU. We see the fuss about the deforestation directive on this, for example. They would need time and assistance to adjust to us no longer buying so much fast fashion, for example. That would affect, for example, the millions of Bangladeshis who are employed in the garment industry who are producing fast fashion for Europe. But it's also those Bangladeshis who are suffering from massive water pollution and other environmental damage in their country because of this fast fashion produced for Europe. So they need time and they need assistance to adjust, but it would take them into a much more sustainable economy, environmentally and climate-wise, for them as well. So we can't just think about this in a transactional way of, oh, Europe has decided to go green and therefore others are going to suffer. No, everybody will be better off if European consumption becomes more sustainable. But there needs to be a change throughout the whole system. And that requires the kind of international cooperation that Yanis was mentioning. And that's why having global material use targets, like we have global carbon emission targets, would really make a big difference. Because then it becomes about how do you share the burden of reaching those targets, rather than, oh, let's just tweak this supply chain or that supply chain and never mind the consequences.
Can I just add one sentence to that? The question which you ask is, of course, extremely fair. And what are the economic consequences? And we need to take it with utmost care that those things are done in a very fair way. But you can't look to those questions only through the economic optic, you know. What is the alternative? That's the question. You know, if we are just looking, either we will all be fair in economic way at the end of the day, where we will all collectively be going? You know, there is one utmost important misunderstanding. We think, and that's already proven that it's not entirely working, that we can tackle the climate change and other environmental issues only by transiting the energy system and adding to that technological development. No, that will not work. It is important and crucial, but material footprint is dangerously under-discussed and material use. And we need to understand that climate change is actually, the effect of climate change is actually due to the ecological overshoot. And ecological overshoot has many components. Among them, one is everything what we extract from the earth, including fossil fuels, by the way. Second, it depends on economic model, which is designed currently in a way that we are really supporting the new resource extraction and not actually the reuse. So we are piling the waste. And the third, it's of course also the growth of human population, not the future one, but the one which happened in the last 50 years, because we have more than doubled the amount of population. So maybe the problem was not seen 50 years ago, but now it's more than obvious. And it's more than obvious that we are overshooting planetary boundaries, and that if we don't do that, the costs, economic costs, will be dramatic. Slovenia was last year hit by the floods and extreme weather events, Do you know what was the cost which the government adopted then later on? 16.9 of 1 year budget, 16.9%. So this is economy. This is not anymore talking about fictional figures, not to mention how the life looks like when you are hit by the flood and when you are hit by extreme weather events. So we have to take those things much more seriously than we are currently discussing them.
So in the last piece of our podcast, I'd very much like to talk about policy measures. Heather, you touched a little bit on essentially the need for pricing in some of these things, which one of the ways to do that is with a carbon price. Another way to do it is with taxes. What's practical with those levers and what other policy measures are there?
There's quite a range of policy measures that can be used once you start thinking about materials efficiency as important as energy efficiency and as important as other goals. So if you think about it, we've had various energy efficiency drives because of oil crises, because of the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, and so on. And that has actually caused big contraction in energy consumption. You know, people do react to that. It's not the case, as sometimes economists claim, that energy consumption is inelastic. It's definitely response to price signals. And materials use would also respond to price signals if prices changed according to the environmental impact of that material's use. And that's that Draghi points to directly. So prices matter, and the quickest way to change prices is to change taxes. For example, we tax labor very highly in Europe. At above 50%, we hardly tax materials use and pollution at all. It's well below 1%, really, really tiny. So we could try and balance that rather better by taxing resource use specifically, and particularly looking at the various inputs into the economy according to their environmental impact and their environmental cost. That would be one way of doing that. Another way is of course, regulation. So things like eco-design, sustainable products directive. The EU has actually put forward a lot of regulations, some of which were actually created during Janez Potocnik's time as commissioner. It's taken a while to get them through the political cycle, but there's a lot in place now. And Ursula von der Leyen has now promised a Circular Economy Act, which will bring in more regulatory instruments that can be used. So that's a good thing. But we also need some fundamental changes to address the market failures. So there are these information failures that Luca was talking about, where firms may not know where they could actually benefit from other firms producing outputs which they could use as inputs, where firms are unaware of waste even inside their own production systems because of past dependency in how they've always done things in their industry, and also by lowering the first mover costs. Because just like with renewable energy, the first firms that start to go for renewable energy or start to go for materials efficiency take a lot of the cost. And then as other companies in their sector see, oh, this could be done, look at the innovation, look at the technology that I could use, look at the different production processes that that firm is using, then the whole sector benefits. So to reduce those first mover disadvantages, those first mover costs, would be a very important way that national and regional governments could play a role, including through the kinds of arbitration schemes that Luca was talking about. So there's a whole range of things that can be done. But the key thing is simply to start treating resources as something that are finite. You can't just buy more of them. They really are finite. And also to see that European competitiveness would be massively enhanced if we produce the most durable products with the most efficient production processes on the planet, because then other countries in other parts of the globe that are really struggling with waste, which is very expensive, and are struggling with inefficient inputs and rising price of commodities, they could adopt European solutions. That would also be very good for European competitiveness or competitiveness of European firms.
So you talk about shifting away from dependence on taxing labor in terms of maybe taxing environmental inputs or other sorts of things. Janez, you know from your time working on the EU budget that labor taxes have the benefit of being much more predictable than taxes on capital or taxes on resources. So how do we work through that?
I think Heather is absolutely right, pointing in that direction. I would even go a bit further, because I firmly believe that if Europe wants to be a strategic power, because one of the sentences which one is hearing in these 20 decades which I was living in European spaces, we are global market number two in trade, we are the major donor to those in needs, but when it comes to strategic debates, we are not properly understood nor treated. And if we want really to improve, our position is basically to better align three of the core policies, which is fiscal policy, which is external policy, and of course defense policy. And defense, it's actually happening. But in the fiscal policies, you know that countries are responsible by themselves. So we are more or less using taxes to compete between each other, the countries, and then collectively complain that we are not competitive on the outside. So it's not only the power of taxing more what we would like less and taxing less what we would like more, but it's also using public procurement, which is enormous power, using the state subsidies and getting rid, if you want, of tax havens, which are basically escape rooms for rich people and rich companies that they don't even pay the fair share. So it's enormous power which is behind that. And I can immediately hear people saying, yeah, this is too ambitious, this will never happen. But listen, if founding fathers of European Union would think in that way, we would not have European Union in the first place. So we need to seriously decide which is the direction we want to go. And I think that in this renewed geostrategical relations, this is exactly the question which we Europeans need to ask ourselves.
Luca, how do you think younger generations will manage this? We've seen so much whiplash between generations that are coming up saying we need to do things differently. And then when they take power, they say, actually, it's our turn now. And we don't want to fix the mistakes of what went before. We want to have a chance to enjoy some of the things that we couldn't when those other folks were in power. How do we keep the momentum as the generations change?
I think one of the major things that can be done is to make the case for resource efficiency, not just in terms of all of its environmental benefits and in terms of the urgency that there is of reducing emissions, of reducing biodiversity loss, reducing pollution, but we have to increasingly make the case, and you see this amongst policymakers increasingly, to make the case for resource efficiency in terms of the real economic outcomes that people see in their day-to-day lives. So we've brushed over competitiveness. There is evidence to suggest that eco-innovations in firms which increase resource efficiency have huge spillover effects in terms of other innovations. So firms, there's a big study which showed that out of 12,000 firms operating across 12 countries within the EU, firms that pursued these eco-innovations in terms of material efficiency saw reduced carbon emissions and increased market share because their innovations led them to discover other areas of their business where they could increase efficiency. So I think, yeah, making the case in terms of not just the urgency and the benefits that this has to climate, but also in the benefits that this has in people's day-to-day lives is really important. Another way we can think about it is by using the provisioning systems logic that Yanez was referring to and which is in the Global Resources Outlook. People want to have good education. People want to have good mobility. People want to have good healthcare. And I think it's uncontroversial to say that we want these things in the most resource-efficient way possible, because most people understand that that has positive spillover effects when it comes to climate and biodiversity and pollution.
Heather, is circular economy the right term?
Circular economy is a great way of thinking about this because it gives people the sense that another kind of economy is possible. And it's really helpful because it also gets it away from the growth-degrowth argument. You don't have to believe in degrowth to see that economies could be much more efficient in their use of resources. But I think we have to think of it not just about circularity, which is a solution, but about the very fundamental problems that circularity is one of the answers to addressing. So circularity is about keeping materials in the productive economy for as long as possible and getting the full value from them to the maximum so that you don't have to use so many of them. But ultimately, the goal is we extract the least from nature because nature can't bear the burden that we humans are putting on it. And that's really what it's about. So how do we meet human needs in the most resource efficient way possible is the key thing. If you think about Kate Raworth's donut economics, where we want to be in the ring of the donut, where putting the least pressure on the earth and still meeting human needs. That's really what this is about. So circularity is one way to achieve that, but also sufficiency, this idea that Jana's put forward, where you use what you need, what is sufficient to meet the human needs. And that doesn't mean you can't live a good life. You can actually have very good living standards in a non-wasteful system. In fact, you could argue that you have a much better because the waste is itself very expensive, in fact. But the circularity is a set of principles which are really helpful for thinking through the economic implications of it. But ultimately, we have to think about it as the relationship between humans and the planet that we live on and how much it's possible for the planet to bear in order to meet our needs. And we could be meeting those needs in much, much more efficient ways.
Jana's, what is your number one piece of advice for the new commission as they take office?
Keep on with the European Green Deal because it's the right direction and deepening that, strengthen it where it's needed. But just to add to what Heather was saying, she was saying in the first place that nature, it's working like the circular economy from the very beginning. So the central question is actually, do we believe that we humans are part of nature? Because if we answer to that positively, we will behave accordingly. But currently we do not behave accordingly, nor we think that we are in a way part of nature, because we behave like the nature is subordinated to us and that we can use it for our purposes. And when we protect nature, if we are honest, we never protect it because we are protecting nature and other beings. We are protecting it because we are afraid of ourselves. So it's very self-centered agenda. And we simply need to understand that all what we are talking about, it's not so much technological issue. It's very much moral issue. And we have indebted future generations terribly, financially and by depleting the nature. And what Luca is saying is absolutely right. We are responsible for what is happening, and we owe them, not that we respect them only at home where they are part of our families, but that we respect them also when we go to our job and want to pocket as much profits as we can in our pockets.
Well, on that note, to consider ourselves as part of nature and part of the world and not just floating above it and sucking the resources out of it, I'd like to encourage our listeners to reuse and enjoy all of the fabulous resources on the Bruegel website, bruegel.org. We will also link to some of the stuff from the International Research Project and how that fits in with our research here. You can find this podcast on all your favorite podcast channels, and we thank you so much for joining us. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. I've been here with Luca Moffat, Heather Graby, and Jana's Potocznik.